senator or doctor or captain of industry, because girls can be whatever they want to be.
I want to train cats to bark.
Good. I think it's cool. And Jackie thinks every girl should grow up and be president, even if they're a liar, liar, pantsuit on fire.
I think we know who's liar and who's on fire, Roseanne.
That was Roseanne, and I am Catherine Mengu Ward, standing in for Matt Welsh as the host of today's Monday Reason podcast. I am joined by Elizabeth Nolan Brown, special correspondent to Real America, and Peter Suderman, who is the managing editor of Reason.com, and of course, Nick Gillespie, who joins us also from some unspecified location. Nick, we don't want to know. The terrorists can't hear about it.
Okay, but I am in the Real America.
You're always in Real America in your heart, we know. So today we are going to talk about the glorious intersection of politics and pop culture that is the new Roseanne show. We are going to talk about the Veterans Affairs Administration and its new leadership. We are going to talk about Amazon and Whole Foods and Trump. And we should just put Trump on the end of all of the topics because that's how it always is everywhere. And hopefully a few more topics besides. Let's start with Roseanne, though. The clip you just heard was Jackie, who I believe in the show is wearing a Nasty Woman t-shirt and also a pussy hat. Is
yes.
that correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Talking about Roseanne's black granddaughter, Mary, and her future prospects. Liz, you have watched both episodes. Tell us what you think.
I mean, it's shocking that not shocking, actually. It's not very surprising at all. But it's weird that it's developed the animosity that it has around it, especially that everyone's been saying that it's a pro-Trump show. Because while the first episode does sort of, you know, it addresses politics and it addresses the election, like you said, we've got Jackie, who's the one sister in the Nasty Woman t-shirt, and she eventually admits she voted for Jill Stein. We've got Darlene, who's the daughter, who I think, you know, they said was a Hillary supporter. And then we've got Roseanne, who was a Trump fan. And they kind of play all of them for laughs. I mean, they play all of them sympathetically, but they also play all of them for laughs as sort of, you know, silly caricatures of people, too. I mean, at one point, Roseanne's like, Jackie says, you know, something about Trump, and she's like, oh, that's what you want the fake news to think. So, I mean, it's definitely did not have a pro-Trump vibe.
I think the reason we're talking about it as a pro-Trump show is because Trump himself is talking about it as a pro-Trump show, right? I mean, this is the highest praise that you can receive from the president of the United States is for him to be standing behind a podium and mention your really great ratings, super great ratings. And this show did indeed have great ratings. 18 million, 19 million, something like that for the first episode. Nick, is it a pro-Trump show?
Yeah, well, Roseanne is pro-Trump. Roseanne Barr, the real Roseanne Barr, and you can follow her at Twitter at the real Roseanne Barr versus Roseanne. I think it's Roseanne on ABC is
Connor.
The show's Twitter. Yeah. But you know, and Roseanne has come out and endorsed Trump in various ways. She had started out as a Bernie bro during the 2016 campaign, but then came along and. You know, it's, I think one of the things, well, I'll say two things about the show. One of the things that it gets right is, and I'm sure we've all been on, you know, in these types of conversations since the election where all of your friends and relatives, when they know that you disagree with them, always want to get, you know, digs in on you. And I think the show and the clip that you played perfectly captures the tedium that goes with that. And I think it's good that it's being played for laughs because it should be. But then the second thing is that both, you know, people on the right and the left or liberals and conservatives really started saying, okay, this show is pro-Trump and hence must either be watched and adored or it must never be talked of again. And so in a way, Roseanne she went on Jimmy Kimmel, I guess it was, who's a big anti-Trump guy, and said, you know, that the show is a place where people can, you know, it models where people can disagree even though they care about each other and remain friends or family. And, you know, that's enough to qualify as a kind of public service in today's America. I think the show is pretty good. Roseanne is a very funny character and has been a ball buster from the beginning of her career on. I mean, when she first emerged under Rodney Dangerfield's tutelage as a domestic goddess, and she would just talk about eating too much and hating her husband and never cleaning up and all of that kind of stuff, to the time when conservatives hated her when she croaked through a ridiculously funny version, it's got to be 20 five plus years ago of the national anthem before a San Diego Padres ball game. She's doing what she's doing, and it's a welcome respite from or respite from the blandness that is most of network sitcoms these days.
I mean, I thought it was pretty appropriate that Roseanne and her ratings got a shout out in Trump's infrastructure speech, right? Where he also announced that maybe we're pulling out of Syria, although no one knows anything about that. And that's what we get in Trump's America is an infrastructure speech in Ohio that's really about Syria and Roseanne. And that's, I think, what I want from national politics. Nick's point actually is the one that interests me most is sort of the shifting role of Roseanne in our kind of cultural and political conversation. And, you know, I'm 36 years old, so I was born in the early 80s. And I remember growing up when Roseanne was just absolutely hated by the kind of social conservative right. And she was an avatar of this kind of rude, rowdy, permissive left and all that was wrong with it because she was okay with sort of different sexual orientations because she was bringing that stuff into the public discourse. And now she is she's the same person, but she is now being touted as an avatar of the political right by the standard bearer for the Republican Party. And it's actually interesting to compare her with, I think, with The Simpsons, which if you recall, mm-hmm. you know, when The Simpsons debuted in, 89, 90, something like that, Bart Simpson was just this, character who was so rude and so crude and really like a symbol of the coarsening of society. And how could any kind of good family go along with this show, right?
Kids at my school used to be forced to take off their I'm an underachiever and proud of it shirts or turn them inside out.
Mark's not allowed to watch Bart Simpson.
I was not allowed to watch Roseanne for a while.
I don't even think I wanted to watch Roseanne, but if I did, I would have been prohibited from doing so. Yeah. And now Ted Cruz goes on stage at CPAC and basically gives an entire interview that's about how much he loves The Simpsons and how the Republican Party is the party, he said, the party of Bart and Homer and Marge and
Lisa
and Maggie. And then Lisa was Democrats were the party of Lisa Simpson was his dig at Democrats on the stage at CPAC. Ted Cruz, who was the runner up for kind of being the avatar of the social conservative Republican right. Like, so these are the two, I mean, arguably the two biggest figures of kind of the center of the Republican Party of the GOP's conservative base. And like their two favorite shows are Roseanne and The Simpsons. And it just kind of to me shows, I mean, it shows on a bunch of things. One is sort of how much this stuff can change, but also kind of how pointless the culture war is and how silly and shallow all of this is, where we're like, no, if you watch Roseanne, you're a bad liberal. Wait, you have to watch Roseanne if you're a good conservative, and how these debates just like they're so meaningless and so tethered to nothing.
And
watch the fucking show and enjoy it if you enjoy it.
On that, on the vein of the culture war thing, I think we'd be remiss if we don't mention the gender thing, because there's also been this interesting gender culture war present in Roseanne. And Roseanne Barr, the person, the real Roseanne, is often accused of being transphobic and being a TERF and things like that,
remind us all what a TERF is.
A TERF is a trans exclusionary rad feminist. It means a feminist who doesn't have the currently correct opinions about gender issues and transgender issues. I'm not sticking up for anything that Roseanne says in her real life, but what's interesting is that on the show, a big facet of it and one of the big central things of the second episode was that she has a grandchild who is not transgender, but was born a boy. I mean, he still considers himself a boy. They still consider him a boy, but he likes to wear dresses and he likes to paint his nails. And the whole thing throughout the second episode is to go through, you know, John Goodman questioning, well, does that mean that he's gay? And then being like, no, he's not gay. And then does that mean, you know, he wants to be a girl? Like, no, he doesn't want to be a girl. He just wants to, you know, experiment with, you know, wearing this and just wear what he wants to do. And so they go through this, which is, you know, I would think what we think of as a very liberal or progressive, you know, view towards gender and it being, you know, sort of non-binary kids and things like that. And it presented that in the context of an audience that it had already primed to be friendly to, a conservative audience that had already been primed to be friendly to this show, because people are viewing it as a pro-Trump show, as a pro, you know, real America show. And so they're seeing the way that people like John Goodman's character and Roseanne's character, who are these, you know, portrayed as these sort of conservative Americans, are reacting in this way to their grandchild. And I think that's really powerful. And that's something that has been sort of lost in this really black and white, you know, is Roseanne good or bad?
Yeah.
You know,
I agree with you, Liz.
Can we take a vote? Is Roseanne good or bad?
Well,
our listeners can't see who put their hands up. So,
two things. One, I think Liz is right that, you know, the show kind of mirrors the inability of contemporary political discourse, certainly, to just kind of, you know, wrap its arm around where people are. Because Roseanne, whether we're talking about the character or the real Roseanne, doesn't fit neatly into, you know, the two major party boxes and the current state of the culture war. And I think that's kind of interesting, as Peter was saying, like, it's not that she's changed, really, because she was always kind of a populist. She's anti-illegal immigrant, according to her tweets. She, and I'm sure we'll talk about her insane endorsement of a particularly idiotic theory about a grand conspiracy of sex trafficking that Trump is single-handedly breaking up. But she's, you know, she hasn't changed all that much, but the culture around her has changed. So she has to fit into one or the other category. And that's true of other shows. Where I would disagree with Peter is saying that, you know, I just watched the show. Because, Peter, I think that's what popular culture is there for. You wouldn't say to, you know, South Park or other shows, oh, just watch the show, right? I mean, there's ways to engage this, the politics of it, which I think need to be more robust than Roseanne said something I agree with, so I love Roseanne, or the opposite.
Yes, that is my point, is not that we should totally ignore all of the social, political, cultural implications of a show. And in fact, I think a smart kind of idiosyncratic sitcom, a popular drama is a good place to engage with these things. But we tend actually not to engage with them. We just sort of tend to label them. Roseanne Barr, good. Roseanne Barr, bad. Roseanne the show, good. Either she's Republican and therefore good or therefore bad. Right. And so the kind of idiotic simplicity here of deciding that these works, often quite complex and nuanced works of art, of entertainment, of drama, are in fact are just meant to be kind of tribal signifiers. That's what bugs me, that conversation and that way of treating art and treating popular culture, I think, is toxic and shallow and is bad for both our politics and our appreciation of art.
No, I agree with you completely, 100%.
I also think there's a danger of conflating, and we've been doing it sort of, or trying to avoid doing it here on this podcast, of the person, in this case, Roseanne, versus the show. The person, Roseanne, has always been just pretty fringy in her political views. She's been deleting a bunch of her controversial tweets. The one that I'm saddest to see go was, what is Kamala Harris's dirty sex secret?
Yeah.
That one's gone now. She ran for
president in 2012 with Cindy Sheehan as her vice president, the anti-war activist. And, she believed in Pizzagate. I mean, this is the real Roseanne.
You will be able to answer, because I saw tweeted this weekend and I haven't been able to look into it yet, that she was a big spreader of the satanic panic stuff in the 80s, and she even like recovered some memories
and destroyed
her relationship with her sister or something.
That's a really interesting backstory. At one point she claimed, and this was after I believe she was either still married to Tom Arnold or it came out shortly after they divorced, but she recovered memories of being abused by her parents, and she severed all ties with her parents and I think with her sister and a couple of other siblings, which she later then recanted those recovered memories and said that it was all a big mistake. So she was a big win for the repressed memory crowd in the 90s and then disappointed them. I mean, she's like Bob Dylan or something. She's becoming Christian just long enough to get a Christian fan base and then becomes a born-again Jew and jettisons that, et cetera. Roseanne is vast and contains multitudes.
Well, I mean, this goes back to Catherine's point about whether we can separate the art from the artist. And, right, like, is Roseanne the television character the same as Roseanne, the real-life human who created the television character? And, of course, there's some overlap, right? On the one hand, you can't fully separate them because the mind that was interested in Pizzagate and satanic sex panics and like that sort of that kind of fringy interest is part of what makes her show so sort of wildly interesting and keeps it from being a very conventional, very sort of boring and didactic type of thing, and is part of what has made her successful. And it's also true, though, that the character she is playing and writing is not simply her. It's not that she's just going on set and being herself around other actors, right? It's it is, I think, a challenge for viewers and for sort of commentators to separate these things without
the singer from the song.
We
need to separate the singer from
the song. I think
the old German philosophy question is happiness the drink or the drinking of the drink?
Oh,
obviously,
God.
It's the drinking, right?
Of course you think it's Germans. The drinking. This is also the problem we're having with our president, right? Is Donald Trump the character he plays on TV, or is Donald Trump something else entirely behind the scenes where maybe he's a fifth dimensional chess player?
But Donald Trump isn't writing he might think he's writing a television show. Actually, you're totally right. Donald Trump is
writing the entire media.
It's a great sitcom, I gotta say.
He's the man in the high castle, I think. Donald
he continues Trump. To staff his inner circle with people who themselves are television stars or either former or aspiring, perhaps. There's a real element there of how much is showmanship. And today's news that somehow now it's the Democrats' fault that immigration reform for the DACA beneficiaries is dead. I think there's a case to be made. Like it's all a long con. I don't know.
Wait,
Hasn't he been blaming
Democrats?
Yeah. Well, on
DACA
Easter
it seems
Sunday,
to be kind of working. People, yeah. On Easter, yeah.
He tweeted Happy Easter, and then the next bunch of tweets he did laid into what sacks of shit the Democrats are, and they're letting all of these Hispanics overrun America,
ruin the lives of the.
Yeah, DACA is. I think, he wants to update the blood libel or the idea that the Jews killed Christ, the Democrats killed Christ.
I've heard that's true. And Roseanne Barr told me that's true. let's talk a little bit about the shakeup. Last week at the Veterans Affairs Administration, Secretary David Shulkin is out. There's been a lot of back and forth. Did he resign? Was he fired? What exactly happened there? That is the same back and forth we get every time there's a change in the leadership team. I think I joined much of America when I heard that Trump had appointed his, quote, personal physician to the role, briefly thought it was that amazing dude in the, like, scraggly gray hair and the lab coat who had pronounced Donald Trump the healthiest human who had ever existed. It turned out not to be that guy, but instead Robert Wilkie, who is a Defense Department official. There is a desperate need for change
you said Robert Wilkie.
Robert Wilkie is not the right person. Ronnie Jackson is the right name.
Ronnie.
Sorry. Ronnie. I think I had in my mind that Ronnie was probably the other guy because that guy looks like a Ronnie. Sorry about that. Wilkie is the acting secretary during the transition. But Ronnie Johnson is the new pick. There's desperate need for change at the Veterans Affairs Administration. And I noticed some commentary this week saying like, oh, it's weird that there's so much attention because nobody ever pays attention to the VA. But of course, we had a major VA scandal at the end of the Obama administration for good reason. Lots of people died on waiting lists and there was much hullabalooing about the need for reform. Nick, is Ronnie Jackson going to bring the reform that we've long waited for?
Oh, most certainly not. He's the doctor who gave rise to the Gerthergate conspiracy. As long as we're talking about Gerthergate conspiracies, and at one point he suggested that Trump might have lived to be 200 had he stopped eating McDonald's all the time earlier in his life. But the VA is one of the most dysfunctional branches of the cabinet, and it was only elevated to cabinet status, I think, under Reagan or Carter, maybe at the very earliest. But it needs systematic reform, partly because of the 2014 scandal you're talking about, which started – in the Phoenix office, where it turned out that the VA was putting on really long wait lists for various veterans, and a bunch of them died while on wait lists. And then they created fake appointment schedules and things like that. And it was this really, I mean, it was like a Jughead Jones cartoon where the VA seemed to be spending as much time faking doing their work rather than just doing it. And that kind of stuff continues. And Shulkin himself has had a bunch of mini scandals in his time. One of the things that is really interesting is that the reform coming out of 2014, one of the main reforms was to give vets vouchers so that they could go to whatever providers they wanted. That was botched too. And it didn't actually cut down on average wait times and things like that. This is a branch which really needs to be completely, you know, shut down and retooled. It shouldn't be this difficult for, you know, veterans to be getting medical care, but it has always been a low priority under all circumstances. And in fact, under Bush, when we went into the wars in Afghanistan and in Iraq, the Bush administration, for all of the extra money and all of the special spending that they lobbed at war efforts, they did not actually provide extra money for vets coming home who would need follow-up medical care. So it's, you know, across the board, liberal, conservative, Republican, Democratic administrations, these are just, it's just been fucked from the beginning.
And the attempts at reform are always kabuki reforms. I mean, during the 2014 scandal or after it, Bob McDonald, who was then the Secretary of Veterans Affairs, was going around bragging that 2/3 of the system's medical centers had new directors, but only 2 of those directors came from outside of the system, right? So they just shifted everybody, sort of everybody move over one chair. Oh, look, you know, here's some reform. And yeah, the Veterans Choice Act was, you know, it's quite similar actually to the Race for the Top reforms in education, right? So there's a teeny bit of money out of just an absolutely enormous budget put towards something that looks a little bit like choice, but is actually still pretty tightly restricted and requires the users, in this case, the veterans, to jump through a lot of hoops to get access to it. The other thing that's going on here is there are about 22 million veterans in the United States, and only 8 million of them are even enrolled in the Veterans Health Administration to begin with. So, you know, it's a system that gives you incredibly heavily subsidized to the point of almost being free care, and yet more than half of the people eligible for it still don't want it. That's how broken it is.
So I think it's right to note how flawed the reforms are, because the reforms basically are all about tweaking around the edges, and they never really kind of want to rethink the VA's fundamental design, which is basically a single payer design. And so Shulkin wasn't a great leader of the VA, but it's hard to be an effective and good leader of a single payer system, because single payer healthcare systems, kind of by nature, you just don't have the information that you need. There's no market mechanisms, right? You're kind of trying to collect and organize and manage everything centrally. And so, you know, I'm pretty fond I'm quite intrigued by the Cato proposal, which would basically return control of the system basically entirely to veterans, privatizing it, but putting it in their hands. And then at the same time, it would also force Congress to pay for veterans' health bills as part of the cost of new conflicts. And so this is the part that is supposed to appeal to liberals, because basically what it would do is raise the cost of going to war in real time by saying that right now, it's sort of, if we want to go launch a war in Iran, or if we want to relaunch a big conflict in Iraq, what we've got to do is price in the payments that we have to make for veterans to get insurance. And those insurance rates will then rise with conflict. And so what that does is it makes it harder for Congress to get into war, harder for us to put people in the military in harm's way. It accurately prices things up front. It funds things correctly. It still pays for veterans' health. And I think this is sort of one area where it's worth just sort of saying that this is, you know, when it comes to healthcare, Liberals, conservatives, and libertarians basically agree the government has a responsibility to pay for the health care of veterans. But we do it in such a terrible way that we are making it more likely that they get into harm's way in the first place, and then that we don't take care of them in the decades afterwards.
Can I just inject a libertarian jerk comment to Peter's? I agree with you 99%, Peter, but I don't think all veterans should get the same level of benefits. And in fact, I understand. But I mean, it's important to note that like combat veterans are one thing and people who are under the stress of serving near or at the front lines. But that's a very small fraction of people who are in the military, and they should not be getting a similar level of benefits. And one of the reasons I bring this up is because every time we reform an entitlement, there's a recent book that came out called The High Cost of Good Intentions, and it's a history of entitlement spending. The earliest entitlements in the United States' history, and this is going back to the early 1800s, had to do with war benefits. And wouldn't you know that, like, immediately more people started applying for early benefits that were tied to, I guess, even the Revolution, but the War of 1812, than pretty much could possibly have been alive when these programs came into place. And that, the biggest one major problem is anytime we create an entitlement or an entitlement mentality, it almost immediately metastasizes, not just out of control in terms of financial things, but also the level of participation.
Would you prefer a price sheet for different damages incurred in the field?
Yes.
We reviewed many years ago one of my favorite weird economics books, which is The Invisible Hook, a book yes. about pirate economics by, Peter Leeson from George Mason. And he includes a bunch of early contractual arrangements, sort of semi-constitutional contractual arrangements between pirate captains and their crews, where there's just specific prices, like one eye, one thumb.
You know, back in the old days of major medical programs, I remember having jobs in the late 80s where you would get the benefits booklet, and it would specify in that if you lost your hand, if it was your non-dominant hand, you would get a certain amount if you lost your entire hand. But then if you lost each finger, you would actually make more money if you lost the fingers individually and added up those payments. And in the office, people would always be, during slow news days, we'd be talking about, would it be better to just lose your hand and get it over with, or to lose each finger sequentially and bank more money, but then be left with a useless stump? So that's what insurance is for.
Well, if you're a pirate, you get a hook. So yeah, that's true. Some upside there, but yeah. Less useful for a journalist, I guess.
Yeah.
So Shulkin has also been part of a cluster of scandals about spending and travel and other attributes of or other perks of the office. Liz, do you have a favorite cabinet scandal at this point? I'm partial to the dining table, Ben Carson's dining table, which is now like his wife chose it. No, his secretary chose it. No, he personally chose it. He personally refinished it while in office, using government money for supplies. Do you have
wives count? Because like anything involving Louise Linton is my favorite. So,
and she's Mnuchin's wife, right? The Secretary of Treasury's wife.
Yes, she's Mnuchin's wife.
Do you just love her for her like Darth Vader fashion?
Yeah,
sense,
I mean, she's got like a Darth Vader meets Cruella De Vil meets like Bond girl sort of fashion sense happening.
But then
she
also
just really oblivious a lot. Yeah. Like, didn't she says these amazing things.
She tweeted out to people like fuck you if you can't tell the difference between I don't even know like Versace and Dolce and Gabbana or something like that. Yeah.
Peter has up on his screen right now a Washingtonian article titled "Is DC Being Too Mean to Louise Linton?" which contains a picture of her in super high-heeled boots, a midriff-bearing shirt with a tiny dog of some kind.
The dog's pretty cute.
She did an interview with one of the women's glossy magazines, and it was all about how like she was a failed sort of D-list actor, and she came here and she thought like she didn't know what politics was like or DC was like, and she thought she was playing the role of, and it's just like she sounds so like adorably clueless.
There's a question though, I think, of if you don't know anything about Washington and you show up and this is how you think you should behave, things have gone off the rails.
She also wrote a book about her saving children in Africa that was apparently so tone deaf that she asked the publisher to pull it a couple of years ago before coming here. So
yeah, but I think there is something about, you know, if you're looking at Washington from the outside and you think like, okay, I'm headed to Washington for the first time, my husband too, by all accounts, doesn't really know himself why he was chosen to head the Treasury.
Was a big
like
fundraiser.
He just met Trump at a party and he was a fundraiser and apparently that was that. But the fact that you would sort of think, I'm headed to Washington, what should I do? And the answer is hashtag my designer clothes on Instagram. We may be headed into kind of a Hunger Games District 1 type
situation. I do think, she should definitely be in the next Hunger Games movie, as one of the District 1.
Steve Mnuchin, if I believe that's how you pronounce his name, he financed movies, right? He slate financed the Warner Brothers films, I believe, through Brett Ratner's Rat Pack Dune Entertainment system. And so he was a big, like, he's the executive producer on Batman v Superman and Mad Max and like this whole list of movies. And it's so great to like, as a movie watcher, to just go and constantly see Steve Mnuchin's name run in the main credits before you're about to watch the latest bad Zack Snyder movie.
So you don't think Andrew Mellon didn't have his hand in some Gloria Swanson silent pictures, Peter?
I don't know where he had his hands.
Yeah, that's true. Well, he seemed to, that was one thing that he kept kind of clean, I guess, during his Treasury Secretary. But, this calls back to Peter's point about, we seem to be populated, politics today is populated by people who are acting as if they're in politics, as opposed to people who are actually in politics. I don't know that that's necessarily a bad thing, because it is true that Trump, think of the Republican tax bill, which is flawed in many ways, none more so than in not raising enough revenue to pay for everything Republicans want to buy. But there's a reason why, like, they never went after, state and local tax deductions, or even the kind of idea of limiting the mortgage interest deduction and a couple of other tax expenditures until Trump came into office. And it's like, you do need people who are from outside the system to really make certain types of reforms, however ill-fated or half-done, possible. I don't know that means Seth Mnuchin is a necessary player here, and his wife, Steve, excuse me. But it's, it's kind of interesting. Yeah.
I mean, that's why I just think that Louise Litton's quotes about that were so funny, because it's kind of like she says what a lot of like the people that are actually in Trump administrations, I think, sort of like, it seems like they feel like they just got here and were like, how do I play a person doing this role? You know,
it also explains why they're wasting. But they're wasting money. I mean, like, they're really shooting themselves in the feet by, and there are a variety of other scandals that involve either actual cabinet members or administration officials, their spouses, their chief of staff spouses, who are just really parking a lot of dough on the public dime in a way that they don't seem to really give a shit about. And that's the type of stuff that really turns people against an administration, especially one that's trying to be populist.
That kind of waste, I think, is totally inexcusable, and people should know better than that, regardless of whether they've been around Washington or not. On the other hand, I don't think there's anything particularly new about the idea that politicians are also actors. I mean, there's a quote, I believe, from Ronald Reagan, who was like, well, of course the president is an actor. How could he not be? Right. I may be slightly misrendering that, but it is basically along those lines. And at least in the kind of modern TV era of post-war American politics, it has always been the case that there has been a kind of acting and performance component to being, certainly to being president, but really these days to being a nationally elected, or even in some cases state elected official at all. And that's not something that is, while I think that the Trump administration leans into that, exaggerates it, that's the only part of that's really sort of the only way that they view politics and their jobs in politics, and that's unique. I don't think the notion that is part of the job, that's one way of approaching it, is something that is.
But this is like
suddenly appeared on the scene.
It's like people doing cold reads and first take, best take. I mean, this is like haven't read the script.
Wildly,
they don't know what they're doing.
Wildly exaggerated in this administration, because you have a president who has no political experience and basically thinks it's like running a reality show. because that's what he did before. He wasn't actually a successful businessman. He was the front man on a reality show that was managed around him.
You'll remember, though, that this was also a huge critique of Obama, that he was inexperienced. They had basically gone from, you know, his first race as a state level official to president in about 5 seconds. And
that's,
I think,
true. And it wasn't totally wrong about Obama, but Obama did, even his background as a community organizer, and you can make fun of that, that is essentially a form of local politics. He was his job was to organize people around causes and sort of get them to agree to compromises in order to affect social and policy change. And he just moved up the ladder pretty quickly. And yes, he also was quite performative. He understood that there was a kind of actorly component to being president, and that was important in the modern media environment.
Also,
but that wasn't the only way that he saw the world.
Yeah, but he also, you know, he also managed to muscle through something Democrats have been trying to do since, you know, the final FDR administration, which was a nationalized healthcare system to greater or lesser degrees. And, you know, I don't think that would have happened with more of an insider, because they would have probably taken the measure. And I mean, he barely got it through, but they would have taken the measure of the political resistance and settled for something even shittier than Obamacare.
We also have in the background the constant, is this president about to be brought down by scandal, which is a very Hollywood situation. We've got in the news yesterday on the Sunday shows, Republican strategist Alex Castellanos.
Recent contributor, by the way.
And recent contributor Alex Castellanos, warning President Trump that he should get good legal help now because a storm is coming. Again, sort of backing our theory that this is just like a badly written screenplay.
A stormy is coming.
Yes,
that's right.
God,
oh, Peter,
damn it,
God
Suderman.
Damn it.
Yeah. Fired. Wow. So basically, I think, you know, this idea of the Mueller investigation as always being one moment away from metastasizing into the thing that brings down the Trump administration. In this case, the argument seems to just be, I don't know, that dude's gotten into a lot of stuff financially over the years. Probably there's something in there, which is probably true. But, you know, it seems like the core of this investigation continues to shift around. I don't know that we need to dig into it too deeply, but that is big news this week. And I guess I wondered if any of y'all think, in fact, the storm is coming.
Can we get like a thunder and lightning sound effect?
No.
Can I make one?
No.
With
my
mouth.
Was this
going
to
report?
No. I just, did he, does he, is he saying that he has secret knowledge of some new thing that's coming or what?
No, he seems to just be saying, listen, from what he knows about the fact that their president has in the past had complicated financial dealings and, you know, the ongoing leaks out of the Mueller investigation, right? Like, you hear nothing from Mueller himself. You hear a huge amount of information about what's happening in the investigation every day. You hear it on Fox. You hear it on MSNBC. You hear it in the newspaper. And the sort of the lack of clarity about what they're even focusing on now, Trump's supposed desire to speak with the, you know, with the investigators. Maybe he's being prohibited from doing that. Maybe he's not. There's so much. It's so blurry. And I think this just vague idea of there's probably something hiding, and these guys sure do seem to be working hard to find
it. Well, look, it's not just financial stuff, though. I mean, last week we saw. So, I mean, for one thing, the Trump campaign has a bunch of the folks who worked there have been indicted or flipped by the Mueller investigation.
The first sentencing is tomorrow.
And
the first guy is going
right,
to be sentenced.
Right, so it's not that there's just nothing there, right? They have found real dirt on these folks. And then last week, we saw a couple of things. One was that the DNC hack that released all of those DNC emails was more directly linked to Russian intelligence than we'd ever seen before. Basically, Guccifer, who released those things, was pinned as clearly
2.0. Please, don't confuse him
I'm
with
sorry,
the,
with Guccifer 1,
beta.
Who is a totally, totally, totally different person, whoever he or she is or they may be. Right, but was Guccifer 2.0 is a Russian agent. And Rick Gates, who is the business partner of Paul Manafort, who is Trump's campaign manager, spent a lot of time apparently communicating directly with Guccifer 2.0, with the Russian intelligence officer who ended up releasing the DNC emails that Trump seemed to perhaps suggest he might have known something about in speeches on the campaign trail that his family and associates were in meetings looking for emails from Hillary Clinton, trying to get dirt that they thought was being offered by the Russia by Russia. Again, it's all still somewhat blurry. It's not like there is a perfectly clear story that has been laid out here, but there's also not nothing. And I think that people need to sort of keep an open mind, kind of both directions.
Yeah, I think there's less here.
Let's
all
make
than
that. Let's make our sounds about how we think.
I'm not allowed to make thunder and lightning and noises, lightning, and you guys can make. Yeah, but,
sad trombone.
Go ahead, Liz.
Wait. What am I? No,
I don't know why we're making that sound.
Nick, I think.
Yeah. Well, I am resolutely. I'm not a fan of Putin, but I'm also not a fan of this like invocation of Russia.
Well, you have to put that caveat on your remarks. No, everything has already gone so wrong.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I really wish I could rewind that.
Wait. So, what about your number one Putin fan Twitter account that I've been?
And hat
yeah, you know,
that
where
I've
I'm riding
wearing
on the back of the unicorn rather than Trump with the shirtless Putin. It's, you know, Russia has become what the corporations were during like the high tide of the anti-globalist movement at the end of the 90s, where you just invoke, you know, Russia. It's like, you know, how it's like Heil Hitler, Heil Russia. It's, you know, it's an indicator that something is evil and rotten. I think there's less to what, you know, has come out about the Mueller stuff. And even in terms of, you know, the indictments, it's not for stuff that is specifically about Trump and the campaign, et cetera. I think, you know, I have two thoughts on this, I guess. One is that I want a president who gets impeached for being a terrible president, not for lying about sex or lying under oath about sex like Clinton did, or something crappy about, you know, if Trump is like, you know, he failed to file certain types of campaign finance laws or something like that. I don't want it to be about that. I want these guys to be put on trial for being terrible presidents, especially when it comes to foreign policy. The other thing, and kind of related to that, is like, we should not stop talking about what was in those hacked emails, because what it showed, and this was something Donna Brazile wrote a great book about this, and then it kind of faded quickly because it didn't fit into where Republicans and Democrats and, you know, MSNBC and Fox News, what they wanted to talk about, it was that the DNC went out of its way to, you know, to tilt the scales towards Hillary Clinton and screw over Bernie Sanders. You know, there was other stuff in there about how, you know, Hillary Clinton was a bad candidate and was hiding like speech transcripts and stuff that she had ordered from people, you know, from Public View and things like that for paid speeches she had made. And, you know, none of that is like, oh, Hillary Clinton is the worst person, you know, except Putin, who is really bad, except we really deeply love him if we're Republican, blah, blah, blah. But it's, you know, there's a lot of stuff there, and we lose focus on that if we just start talking about like, oh, you know, it looks like Mueller's closing in and, you know, Trump better be careful. It's like, let's talk about the issues that are being, you know, actually brought to bear here. And I think that always goes out the window in these kinds of conversations.
But and I think we're actually going to go one level even further from that. I mean, when I'm talking about the Castellanos quote and he's saying, oh, there are complicated financial history there, like, I think if anything, the place that this investigation winds up is like finding some kind of impropriety that is, you know, four levels down from anything substantive, but does in fact violate, you know, federal
and
law.
And there is that
the
Hail Marys that keep getting, because like I've been seeing more and more now about related to the business dealings is, you know, we're going to get Trump through the emoluments, you know, clause in
I'm
the
excited,
Constitution.
Though, that we keep saying the word emoluments so much in our political discourse.
But
now.
It's always something. And this is also the curse of the independent or special prosecutors, where every president, at least since Clinton, and actually going back to Reagan, who had one against him, you know, for Iran-Contra, which was a serious, you know, abrogation of constitutional legitimacy, I think. But, you know, it's almost like you have, you know, at the inauguration, they should attach like a lamprey to the president's belly and just say, okay, you're going to be living with this thing, sucking, you know, nutrients and blood out of your presidency for as long as you're in office. Almost certainly it won't, it definitely won't kill you, but it will weaken you. And it will, you know, at the right moment, we're going to flare up with, you know, Lamprey stuff so that we can weaken your political prospects. It's, it just seems like a bad way to be running stuff because, you know, if Harvey Silverglate, recent contributor, FIRE co-founder, Shadow University co-author is right, when he says, you know, we all commit at least 3 felonies a day because of overcriminalization, it's got to be like 81 felonies a day for anybody who's in a position to become president.
I just like that. I mean, that we're saying emoluments too, because it reminds, it seems like it should be an ingredient of some sort, yeah. like some sort of root or spice. I don't want to make like emoluments bitters. You know,
you can get it at
and make an old fashioned.
The herb at the Herb de Provence stall at a local shopping mall. I'll take some emoluments, please.
Just to
go
back to what Nick said, though, about what we're, you know, the kind of things we're getting people on and the kind of the people that have already been indicted and stuff. I also think that there's way less there than it is being made of it, because I've read like so many of these indictments, too. And if you read them, I mean, like the guy, Alexander Van der Swan, who's Paul Manafort's nephew. But he's the one who's supposed to be sentenced tomorrow, and he's guilty of lying to the FBI. But if you look at, I mean, him, like people like him and George Papadopoulos and things, the things that they lied to the FBI about, I mean, were often not even anything that was huge. It was like them just emailing with someone who was like, hey, I might have some information. And then they emailed, and then they told the FBI that they didn't email them back, but they did. And it was like, it's very sort of minor stuff. It almost, I mean, I read it and I just get mad at the FBI, obviously, in this, because it just seems like such an overreach that they're, I don't know. I mean, I think that there's, even though these might be despicable people, they're also sort of, there's a lot of people ancillary to this whole thing who are just sort of being bullied by the FBI over things that aren't really that big of a deal.
I want to talk really quickly about Donald Trump and his strong feelings about Amazon, which have come out in the last few days. This morning he tweeted, only fools or worse are saying that our money-losing post office makes money with Amazon. They lose a fortune, and this will be changed. Also, our fully tax-paying retailers are closing stores all over the country. Not a level playing field. This is only the most recent of several Trump tweets about Amazon, alleging that the fact that Amazon sends packages through the postal service is somehow to be added to their list of crimes, along with, of course, it's the company's association with the money-losing Washington Post, as he frequently refers to it. So Amazon is the greatest thing that has ever happened of all time, is my super subtle editorial view on this question. But I'm particularly intrigued by this post office angle because A, libertarians love to hate the post office. B, of course, we're always joking about privatizing it / actively trying to privatize it with all of our efforts.
We're not
but
joking.
I think it's like a lose-lose, right? If Amazon exclusively used private package delivery, Trump would be saying Amazon should use the postal service. It's un-American that they don't use the postal service. Because Amazon does use the postal service, Trump is saying, how dare they take advantage of this subsidized public institution? Is there any way that Amazon could be doing the right thing here,
Peter? I'll start by saying, full disclosure, my wife works for the Washington Post, which is owned by Jeff Bezos, who also owns Amazon.com. Also, full disclosure, I order literally everything from Amazon and did long before anyone in my household was employed by or in talks to be employed by Jeff Bezos. Look, it is just very difficult to see this as anything other than a kind of narcissistic, politically motivated attack. Trump was attacking Jeff Bezos and Amazon on the campaign trail long before he started going after Amazon's postal service usage. There's no way for Amazon to do this right. I mean, it's kind of crazy, right? In like the postal service exists, it charges the rates that it charges. Amazon is using it. Should they not be using it? Should they be exclusively using UPS? Like, this isn't some sort of like nuanced policy point that coming from Donald Trump, shockingly, because he usually does that, right? This is just about criticizing the sort of the money making, the sort of, or the large corporate the large corporation that is owned by the same guy who owns one of the newspapers that is most aggressively reporting on and revealing what Donald Trump's administration is doing. He doesn't like that. He doesn't like he doesn't like the reporting that he sees on the front page of the New York Times and the Washington Post. And so he's going to go after the he's going to try and portray those the related organizations as losers, as un-American, as sort of organizations that are that need to be attacked for whatever reason. And this is just the excuse he's ginned up.
I think there's also a kind of mythic showdown going on here, though, too, which is worth thinking about, which is that, you know, Amazon represents the future of e-commerce, which we also need to, you know, recognize that all of us, both, you know, on this call as or on this podcast, plus listening to this podcast, probably tip very heavily into Amazon users and Uber users and Airbnb in a way that a lot of people don't. E-commerce is still like 10% of annual retail in the country. It's not, you know, it's not 50%. It's not 70%. It's actually a small minority.
In my house, it's like 100%.
I get that.
So
I get,
like,
but you're a coastal elite.
It's actually 110% in my house because I return a lot of stuff. So.
All I'm saying is that's unrepresentative. But it's, you know, Trump is also, you know, think about it. This is a guy who doesn't use email. And this is a guy who believes in bricks and mortar. He's a real estate developer. And, you know, I think it's partly just personal. But it's also like he recognizes that Bezos is a different species from him. And that and I think he's reacting.
You mean like actually a good businessman who.
Yeah, well, that's
some people say, helped people and made their lives better.
I think he means Bezos is literally superhuman and is like made of different genetic stuff.
What worries me about some of this stuff is that when you get stuff like, OK, we're in a full blown Facebook panic about social media because the Russians, again, you know, the Russians infiltrated Facebook and they put out fake news, all of that kind of stuff. You get a president who is a populist and who is ginning up a lot of anger at e-commerce and, you know, shadowy internet businesses that don't really, you know, they don't put a screw, you know, into a piece of wood or something like that. You know, they're ripping us off. We are we're coming out of a net neutrality phase, but people are, you know, certainly people in the Democratic Party and a lot of people on the right are saying we need to regulate this new economy. It's been around long enough. It's been around for 20 or 30 years, you know, or less. And now it's time to start regulating it. And I think Trump is abetting that. It, for all of his deregulatory cant in other areas, he dislikes e-commerce and anything related to the internet and anything related to the media. He talks about this. And I think that's, you know, it's something that we need to really push back on all the time.
This is, I mean, just one of the sort of recurring issues with Trump is that he's basically a kind of avatar of old, grumpy, reactionary grandpa politics, right? I mean, his base is the is quite old, quite sort of set in their ways, right? Sort of his primary medium of communication is, I think, arguably not Twitter, but cable television. And that is, and that's also his like primary way of encountering the world based on the reports we've seen is that he spends a huge amount of his day just watching cable television and then kind of live tweeting it, right? And he's basically the, you know, the old man yells at cloud, except not at all sympathetic. And he's
I'm looking forward to the million office of the million of the rascal scooter march on Washington, where a bunch of slow moving Medicare paid for scooters march down Pennsylvania Avenue towards the White
right,
House.
Right. I mean,
and
there are policy implications to this. This is why, or part of why, I should say, Trump has repeatedly promised not to touch Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, has basically said entitlement reform is totally off the table because his base is seniors. His base is a lot of people who benefit directly from entitlements as they are structured today.
If I can also add, there's real questions about the post office, you know, and it's funny, I've seen a bunch of conservatives say, oh, well, you know, the post office is actually mentioned in the Constitution. So, you know, along there with defense and, you know, a couple of other things, it absolutely needs to be provided by the federal government. Since the early 70s, when it was effectively spun off, but not quite as a private company, the post office is in kind of the worst of all possible worlds, where it's supposed to be treat itself like a regular business, a private business, but everything important about it is regulated by either a presidential commission or Congress. So it's impossible. The postmaster general, you know, every postmaster general for the past 20 or 30 years has said we ought to get rid of everyday delivery. We ought to close, you know, up to a third or more post offices that aren't used anymore. They can't get anything done. The most that they can do is get minor increases in first class letter stamp postage through on a semi-regular basis, and that doesn't even exist anymore. There's, you know, the first class letter, which it has a technical monopoly on, doesn't really exist anymore. It would be great to see Trump actually say, you know, what we're going to do is we're going to free up free up the post office to actually compete, and that solves everybody's problem.
I think what's actually going to solve everybody's problems are Amazon delivery drones, and that's going to render this entire conversation.
But then the FAA gets into the, you know, they're already licensing drones.
No! So. Blocked at every turn!
I think it's pretty clear that Roseanne, at least the character, would side with Trump on this, so that brings us full circle. Before we go, I want to do our now regular Have You Seen segment, in which people talk about things they are consuming. I will start, because what I consumed this weekend was the Exodus story. I went to two Passover Seders. And the second one that I attended, the family uses what they refer to affectionately as the Martin Luther King Haggadah, which is it's from like 1972 or something. And it just, the whole point of this telling of the Exodus story is to link it to the civil rights movement. And it's pretty great. It's actually, I always find it kind of inspirational. I think the lesson here is if you enslave people, God will send a bunch of lice to infest your cattle and kill your firstborn. Therefore, God is a libertarian.
Wow. I don't know. Wow. I'll just leave it with
you should
wow.
Leave it at that.
No, so mine is The Death of Stalin. A great movie created by the same, directed and written by the creator of Veep and movies like In the Loop. And it sort of takes place at the moment that Stalin dies and the Soviet Union, sort of the council sort of is trying to figure out exactly what to do and jockeying for control. And it's brilliant and caustic, and it, in some ways it's related to, you know, you see a lot of overlap with like Veep, which really just kind of makes the, I don't know, argument, but kind of repeatedly makes the point that the people who are in power and who desire power and who are jockeying for it are really sort of pathetic people. Except that in this case, it's making it not with the vice president, with sort of an office that is in many ways basically harmless and in a political system that is it has a lot that's good to, you know, sort of that's good about it. It's making that same point about a political system that was just deeply, deeply evil. And so it kind of bravely does not shy away from the evil of the communist rule and of Stalin and even of his successors, Khrushchev, who it sort of on the one hand portrays as a liberalizer, but also willing to go to pretty dark places in order to consolidate his power. And so it's really a kind of I in some ways the movie left me a little bit cold. But that's also, and I think, sort of how it should be, because it is a movie about the ways that those who seek power and are evil can also be shallow and weak and just kind of pathetic little creatures.
Like Pharaoh. No. Nick, what have you seen?
Wow.
Boy, I am going to go with an actual book, a book that's in paper, and it's Albert O. Hirschman's classic early 70s, late 60s book, Exit, Voice, and Loyalty, Responses to Decline in Firms, Organizations, and States. I read it for the first time about 25 years ago, but Hirschman was a political economist who said that individuals have basically three responses, possible responses to a group or an organization, whether it's a country, whether it's a company, or whether it's a family that you want to leave and or that you want to reform. You can either just give up and become loyal, become like a company man. You can express voice through the mechanisms within the system, or you can leave. And it's an immensely powerful book. It seems to me that, you know, it is due for, I mean, it's been in a high esteem since it was published, although not enough to have a Kindle version of it, which is very frustrating. So I had to buy it via paperback or via paper, and I got it over Amazon in 2 to 3 days through the U.S. Postal Service. But it's a fantastic book, and I recommend anybody who's interested in political economy and how do you reform things. You know, Hirschman's Exit, Voice, and Loyalty is just a phenomenal piece of work.
Nick, you put a lot of context on that, so I'm going to give you the benefit of the doubt, but that sounded 100% like you rotated your chair toward the nearest bookshelf, yanked something off of it, and read the title.
I am not speaking from my house, and I pulled it out of my bag.
The best lie is the simplest lie, and that was pretty complicated. So, okay. Well, Nick really bought this book. Liz, what have you seen?
Receipts. Receipts will be in the text field for this podcast.
I just started watching Occupied, which is a Norwegian show that's I got 2 seasons so far. They're both on Netflix now, and the second season just was released on Netflix recently.
Is it about Nazis?
No, it's about a near future where Russia has taken over Norway because Norway decided it was going to stop selling gas and oil to people. And the U.S. has achieved energy independence, it says at the outset of the show, and like doesn't even factor in because we're pretty much just isolationist and just whatever. But Norway says it's not going to sell any more gas to people, and the EU and Russia get mad and Russia occupies it. I've only just started watching it, but it's really good so far. And it's in Norwegian, though. It's subtitled. So that's just a fair warning. You can't watch it in the background, which is how I like to watch TV a lot. So,
thank you very much, everyone, for your recommendations as well as for your news and views. This has been the Reason Podcast. Thank you for joining us. And you can go check us out on iTunes, where you should rate and review us while you're there.